Top 100 Project.
And action.
Hello, hello, everyone. It's the Top 100 Project, taking a long look back at the pictures on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. If you haven't seen A Streetcar Named Desire after all these years, we will spoil the whole thing for you in this podcast. I'm Ryan Ellis with my dazzling wife, Bev.
That's me.
She is dazzling. The coming attractions trivia question. Marlon Brando, Carl Malden, and Kim Hunter played the same roles in the film that they'd played on stage. Vivian Leigh was the newcomer. Whom did she replace when the play became a movie?
It was Jessica Tandy.
You saw that in your research, didn't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have known it otherwise.
Jessica Tandy, probably most famous from Driving Miss Daisy in 1989. The Best Picture winner, Best Actress. Mm-hmm. She did many other movies, and she was quite an old lady by that point.
Vivian Leigh was playing Blanche in the London production of Streetcar Named Desire.
Mm.
And
She wasn't new to it, that's right.
Yeah, and she was a way bigger star than Tandy.
Bigger star than any of these people.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's why she was cast for her stardom.
Yeah, and in a way, for her to play a fading Southern Belle, it kind of played into the persona that she built with Gone with the Wind. Mm. And you do, it does invoke memories of that film when you're seeing this and you're seeing her. It's almost like what would have happened to Scarlett O'Hara had she been weak, had she not been able to cope with the slings and arrows of her fortune.
Yeah, it's an important point to add about her being weak, because Scarlett was not. As we
discussed
many months ago when we did Gone with the Wind. Like that movie or not like that movie, the one thing about that character is she is a tough young lady.
Yeah, and like that character or not like that character, yeah, she's a spitfire.
These are easily Vivian Leigh's two most famous roles.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
There was one other interesting note about her replacing Jessica Tandy, and that was that because most of the cast and the director and, of course, the writer, Tennessee Williams, it's all the same people from New York. And they had all worked together and become really close. And so when Vivian Leigh came in, she was kind of an interloper. And Elie Kazan is a big method director with his method actors. He told her to use that in her performance, use that feeling of alienation to help bring Blanche to life.
Yeah, that's true. I've read that in other films, too. Sometimes where a director will play that up and sometimes even be dishonest with their actors to get them to respond in that way. Oh, Bob over there doesn't think you're doing a very good job. Or Bob over there thinks you're doing a great job. And it makes him paranoid. All right, well, the Top 100 Project's 40th movie, A Streetcar Named Desire, was 45th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, between The Birth of a Nation and A Clockwork Orange. But Streetcar continues our recent trend of AFIers that took a dip between 98 and 07, ranking 47th betwixt It Happened One Night and Rear Window. Warner Brothers released Streetcar on September 19th, 1951. Very big hit. If people weren't going to see A Place in the Sun that fall, they were probably going to see Streetcar. The critics praised it, too. And Bev will tell us what the movie's all about with the skinny.
Mentally unbalanced Blanche DuBois, played by Vivian Leigh, makes an extended visit in the cramped Louisiana apartment of her sister Stella, played by Kim Hunter, and Stella's husband Stanley, played by Marlon Brando. Blanche's proper Southern Belle routine takes a mental and eventually physical pounding from her feral, sexual brother-in-law.
Or in a nutshell, Southern man successfully gets rid of house guest to make room for his baby.
Yeah, probably more to get the space back for himself and his poker-playing buddies.
Yeah, he never wanted Blanche there in the first place. All right, we've already gone on quite a while here before we really get to the heart of the matter, but let's get to it now. What did you think of the movie?
Oh, I loved it. It's incredible. It really lived up to the hype. Like I mentioned in last week's podcast, how I've never managed to see this movie before is, I mean, I'm a little embarrassed to admit, this is the first time I ever watched it. It's such a classic. It's so lauded, and people talk about it so much. And somehow, it wasn't spoiled for me all that much. I mean, I knew a few things. I knew about the rape. I know that Blanche goes crazy. But I didn't know really a lot of the details and ins and outs.
Not even The Simpsons spoiled it for you, huh?
Well, The Simpsons. But if you think about it, they don't really reveal that many plot details.
In their musical.
Her descent into madness while she's up on the ropes being swung around. It symbolizes her descent into madness. It's not just great to watch, it's just so dynamic and incredible and interesting. There's so much depth to the script. I don't even know where to begin. I don't think we could possibly cover in a one podcast the breadth of this work by Tennessee Williams and the story and the characters and the language. But I also kept thinking about it for days afterwards. It was one of those movies that in a great way stayed on my mind for days.
You just mentioned, would you say dynamic?
Mm-hmm.
And that's funny because this essentially is a photograph stage play. And in the play,
yes.
they just stay in the apartment and the apartment above, but with Eunice, and the courtyard. and that's it. But in the movie, they expanded. We're mostly there, but we see the bowling alley. We see where Stanley works. We see a little bit more. We first see Blanche coming into Louisiana.
It does look like a filmed play,
New Orleans, I mean. Yeah, it still looks like a film play, yeah. Mm-hmm. And most movies we've been watching on the project look like what they're supposed to be. The big epics or Outside.
Yeah, I think we'll see that again when we see Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
And 12 Angry Men before that, actually.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because it's just... when a writer has written a great play, of course it has to take place in a limited amount of locations, mm-hmm. but they use it really well in the film. The location, the set, that
won the apartment, Oscar.
As it should have. There's something about it. It is a character in itself of the movie. I read that Kazan had the walls built so that they would move in and out to reflect the claustrophobia and madness that Blanche was going through, and the apartment feels really claustrophobic. They don't have walls, they just have drapes everywhere, and...
there's not much room to begin with, but by the end, it might as well be there on top of each other.
Yeah, and if you feel that, it's great. The windows, everything that's going on outside, I think they're in the French Quarter, right, mm-hmm. in Louisiana. So all the goings-on that's going on around them, it brings so much more life to the film. It really is like an additional character.
Yeah, it felt so authentic, and yet, ironically, they departed from the play because they had to, because of censorship.
Mm-hmm.
Mentions of homosexuality and the infamous rape at the end.
They kept the tone as similar, I think, as they could, but they just had to kind of deke around the specific details of what the characters
were. And there are other things that we have now seen on the DVD that are there for anybody to see now, but weren't when the movie came out in 1951.
Right. There were cuts made that Kazan wasn't even aware of, apparently, by the League of Decency. I can't remember what they... Do you remember?
The Catholic Legion of Decency?
Yeah. They took the film and they just cut a whole pile of things out, then made that the theatrical version without Kazan having anything to say about it.
And one of the big things that was edited is one of my favorite moments in any AFI movie we've seen, after 40 of these now, and it's Kim Hunter, who's never given nearly enough credit for how good she is in this movie. She won an Oscar. Mulan won the Oscar. Lee won the Oscar. Brando didn't. But the moment after the initial fight, everyone who knows this movie probably knows there's more than one fight in this film, but the one where Brando smacks people around and it ends with the, "Hey, Stella!" at the bottom of the stairs. But she's gone up to Eunice's apartment, and you get the feeling this has happened many times before. He goes out there, he's all wet, his shirt is ripped. But the shots of her reaction to that were cut. The look on her face, this is the rare example that we've seen yet of a character who is just horny. Blanche is too. We'll get to Blanche in a minute.
Yeah.
But Stella loves Stanley, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But she also just lusts after
him. Yeah, she's hot for him.
And even though they just had a brutal fight, it's supposed to be minutes later, and she comes down those stairs, and they cut out some of the shots to show her reacting the way she does, which was kind of sexy.
Yeah, she's turned on, but it's the reconciliation part of abuse, right? And she knows now that he's going to dote on her, and this is probably when she desires his attention so much.
The makeup sex will be incredible.
The makeup sex will be like the best she'll ever get of Stanley's attention, and she wants that, and she wants him. And Blanche kind of wants him initially. I'm not sure definitely. If you could say that about her at the end, but initially when she first sees him, she has to just kind of recognize.
If you could get into a character's head what they're actually thinking, Blanche would be thinking, I want him now.
Yeah, and because he's sexy, right?
He is better looking than either one of them.
Oh, yeah.
I'm saying this as a guy.
Yeah, and because I had never seen the movie before, and everybody always talks about notorious young Marlon Brando and that t-shirt and just his nature, just his animalistic way about
him. Sweaty shirt, torso.
And just his mannerisms, like his swagger is irresistible. You look at him and you can't look away. He really is the sexiest character we've had in any movie, period. Although by the end, I find him despicable. He does a great job of making Stanley relatable and stopping the audience from finding him 100% detestable and making him just like a straight up mustache twirling villain.
Yeah.
He's not Billy Zane in Titanic. He's way more complex.
In his quiet moments with Stella, you can tell that they actually, before Blanche got there, generally would have had quiet nights. I get the feeling they did.
Well, there has to be some positive to the relationship. Yeah. Otherwise, what is Stella doing there? She can't just stay with this guy because she's turned on by him.
But when he drinks, like a lot of people who drink, he gets a little nuts.
Yeah, and he's with his buddies and he just wants to get his way, and then he does. He picks on his friends and he's mean to everybody. He's really kind of a brute to everyone. He's a brute to Mitch. He's certainly a brute to the women, but he's also like not all that kind to his friends. He's really not a good dude. When people talk about, I kind of felt like disappointed by the time the film ended at how much women still kind of find him this sex symbol. I found that a little off-putting and disturbing that anybody, after everything his character exhibits, could still be into him, be turned on by him. It's like those girls who still tweet that they love Chris Brown so much. But it feels like the same sort of thing. It's like, oh my god, it boggles my mind that anybody could continue to find a character attractive who behaves in the way that he behaves without remorse.
I bet there are plenty of women out there who like him more for that.
Oh, god.
As the movie goes on, they might be more turned on by
him. Another great Kim Hunter scene is when Blanche is so taken aback by Stanley's temper and how he's behaved, and Stella's reaction to Stanley's temper, and Stella describes the night of their honeymoon when he ran from room to room and broke all the light bulbs with
her slipper. Yeah.
And she says, you know, I kind of liked it.
I was sort of thrilled by it.
I was sort of thrilled by it. And meaning, I was sort of turned on by it. So she's the type of person that is kind of attracted to that drama, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why she can get drawn into this cycle with Stanley.
And Blanche clearly likes younger men. And even though Vivian Leigh was only 38, I guess, when this movie came out, not that old, they made her look a little older with makeup and lighting. And she played it the way she did, which makes her seem a lot older. Brando was a young man, but he was not that much younger than her. But the movie plays it off that Stella's older than Stanley and that Blanche is quite a bit older than all of them. She's the faded Southern dame without a dime.
She's an interesting character. I just got that. Now, you thought there was some ambiguity about just how violent Stanley is, and that you can call into question whether or not he actually hits Stella in the famous fight scene before he calls her name at the bottom of the
stairs. People are pushing him around and yanking his shirt off and throwing him in the shower, as they probably should. And Stella is pushing around his friends, knocking them off their chairs and everything. But he doesn't really punch anybody that I can see. That's
no,
kind of the
but
point.
He does. They go around the corner into the second room. Yes, they do. When all the guys, like, there's all this hullabaloo going on. And I think he chases her into the bedroom. And then you see clearly, like, pull his hand back and punch her.
I don't believe
you. You know they do. Seriously. You didn't see that. There's a lot going on in that scene.
This is the Top 100 Project first. We're going to stop the podcast and we're going to go watch
we'll
that part
it.
Of the movie.
Yeah, let's do it.
And let's go find out who's right.
Well, well, well. Guess who won that argument, ladies and gentlemen?
I don't think I've ever seen that before in this movie. I've seen the movie probably half dozen times.
Well, I wonder if that was one of the details that they had to be sensitive about the censors.
Well, it's smart that they have her end up in the bedroom. You can't see her, but you definitely see him pull back and hit her. He must hit her. We don't see any contact made. And it looks like he might hit her more than once before everyone crowds in and grabs him.
It's an incredible scene. It's so well blocked and just like physically acted. Yeah. Like you can't imagine how much the actors have to work to make that work without anybody
and not hurt each other. Yeah,
yeah, but sure. Also to make it look as natural as and fluid as it does. Yeah. It was really, really well done. But we have eliminated the question of whether or not Stanley actually hits her.
I will eat crow. Yeah, I never thought he did, because he knows that she's pregnant at that point too. So it's even worse that he's,
you know,
it's bad enough you hit anybody, but or you let alone your wife, but you're hitting a pregnant wife.
It is a statistical fact, and it's a significant statistical difference that most abusive relationships, abuse either starts or dramatically escalates when the woman gets pregnant for the first time.
Why?
The theory goes that now he can really get away with doing whatever he wants because she's stuck with him, because now they have a baby.
Especially back in the days when, I don't think, no, Stella has a job, does she? So she's got to rely on him
for the
breadwinner. She's going to make he's going to make the money, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's pretty tragic.
And another thing that's a little bit vague, although I don't think anybody ever disputes the truth of this scene, is that whether or not or how Stanley rapes Blanche at the end of the film. I think when we saw it, it was kind of ambiguous, but in just about everything you read about it, it takes it as total face value. And maybe in the play it's clearer, because they could get away with more on Broadway at the time than they could in the movies. But that rape is a really brilliant scene, and it's like a really great example of that truism that rape is about control, it's not about lust. Even though the movie has so much about lust, never ever is Stanley has the hots for Blanche. And they cut from the scene, he rapes her, he looms over her. So it cuts from a shot of the broken mirror that's kind of witnessing what's going on, although it's incomprehensible visually. It cuts from that to a hose washing garbage off the street, which is, you know, a not very subtle metaphor for exactly what Stanley's doing. He's raping her to get rid of her. Because
he never wanted her in the first place.
He never wanted her there in the first place. He has a new baby coming. It's his first chance where he's alone with her. The cell is not there. Yeah. And it's his first opportunity to do something so awful to her that she cannot stay.
And she's already 3/4 of the way into Looney Town as it is of the whole incident with Mitch. Not that Mitch
not
is anything terrible.
She was like, if she was 75% then she was at least 50% when she showed up at
and
their door in the first
here's
place.
Here's the delicate part of this conversation. We had part of this conversation the night we watched the movie, which was a few days ago. I'm not saying that she wanted him that way, but purely in an animalistic kind of way that we all have, that lizard brain that people call that. When she first sees him, she wants him. She likes younger men. She's... We know that from her history that she's been easy. And that's one reason why Mitch wants to marry her. Mitch wants her in an innocent sort of southern gentleman kind of way. And when he finds out her history,
he buys into her.
He hears the truth, which we all say we want the truth about people, then suddenly, oh, no, I don't want you that way. Yeah. I'll sleep with you, but I don't want to marry you anymore.
It's like, I can't marry you now. That's what he says. And then I can't marry you.
And he leaves, and she makes up a story for Stanley, which isn't even true, that Mitch came back and apologized and everything's fine. And she's just that close to being nuts as
she's succumbing to delusion at that point. There's the whole, the yacht, the Caribbean cruise that she's supposed to be invited to that doesn't even make sense.
But the movie's smart about this. Now, I was wrong a minute ago about Stella getting hit by Stanley. Mm-hmm. But I think it's interesting that, okay, he's an abusive lout, obviously. He's hitting his wife ever, but especially when she's pregnant. But just before that happens, she's yanking people around, the guys around, getting physical with them. If she's a shrinking violet, it's, I think, a little different. I mean, it's easy for a guy to say this. I just think it's a little different than if she's completely cowed. I mean, she's admitted she gets off on his violence. Not against her, but his violence in some sort of
way. There's a lot of study and literature about why women stay in abusive relationships and why men who are abusive marry certain kinds of women. And in a way, they will pick better victims. And a better victim is somebody that they can justify being cruel to. So that's part of it. So Stella sticks up for herself. She fights back. She picks on his friends. She's never, ever gonna beat Stanley in a fight in a million years. Even if he was not a big brute of a dude like he is, even if he was a smaller than average guy, she's still never gonna beat him in a fight. He never has to feel physically threatened by her. And if you wanna know, is he somehow justified in his abuse? Well, he feels justified because when everything is said and done, he always gets his way. No matter how much she hates when his friends come over and he gets drunk and plays cards, he still does it. He doesn't care what she thinks. He doesn't want the music on. He throws the radio out the window. He doesn't want to help her clear the table. He throws everything around and leaves the mess for her to clean up.
Funny scene, though.
It's a funny scene, but you know
what?
It's
awful, but it's funny.
But it's actually a really typical scene of how abusive relationships play out, because a big incentive for these men to treat their wives the way they do is to literally get out of chores and get to do whatever they want, because all they have to do is throw one hissy fit like that, and then the next time she's gonna be like, it's better, it's easier if I just clear the table.
And you know what, as you're talking and visualizing that scene, I'm picturing the scene in Batman. This is gonna sound weird, but the scene where the Joker first meets Vicki Vale, and he lights candles with like this blowtorch type thing. So this violent moment happens, and then, is that your portfolio? And this gentle voice. Well, same thing. Throw the plate against the wall on a streetcar, and oh, I'm all done here. You want me to clean up after you? So in both movies, it's played for a laugh, but maybe that was Nicholson doing an homage to his friend Brando.
Sure, maybe. Actually, yeah, you may be right. But it's an intimidation technique, and it works. In the end, he just always gets his way. He wins in the end. In the movie, it's strongly implied that she's going to leave him because she doesn't want her daughter to kind of grow up in this household. But in the play, it's far more ambiguous. In the play,
which is a better ending, I think.
She takes Stanley's side in the fight between him and Blanche, because Blanche tells Stella that Stanley raped her.
And she even says in the movie something like,
she says, like, how can I stay here if what she says is true? If I concede to believe Blanche's story, then I'm out on my own, because no woman could stay with a husband that did that to her sister or did that at all. And that's actually a great illustration of why acquaintance rape can in many ways be even more traumatic than stranger rape. I mean, it's a topic that's been in the news a lot, legitimate rape. Well, what's more traumatic? Blanche only has Stella. So if she were to get raped by a stranger and tell Stella, Stella would probably take care of her. Stella would believe her. Stella would help her recover from that trauma. Yeah. But then when it's Stella's husband that does that, then not only does she have to suffer the trauma of the rape, she has to suffer the trauma of any lack of trust she has with this man that she has to continue to live with now, and she has to suffer the indignity of her sister refusing to believe her story.
You know what that plays into is a great documentary we saw, I think it was last year, yes. Invisible War.
Was it 2 years ago, I think, because we saw it at the festival, yeah.
Military people who get raped, and of course, generally it's women, but there are an awful lot of men, too.
There are an awful lot of men. That was a kind of a flaw in the movie that they didn't cover. They were uneven with that coverage.
But in that case, the women and men have to tell this to their superior officer who may have been involved or is in some way maybe friends with these people.
Sure.
And so it gets glossed over all the time.
And one of the things they say is when you're in a squadron or platoon or whatever, in a group with these guys, they are like your brother. Like, a lot of people in the military always describe it like, this is your family. Like, you're super close. To lose trust in somebody that you're that close with, that you sometimes rely on to save your life, to protect you from really scary stuff, And then that person betrays your trust so completely, and in some of the stories in that movie, in a very violent manner, and in really terrifying stories. Yeah. That's an additional trauma that's harder to recover
Which
from.
Which plays into exactly what you're saying. And Blanche's history, she tells Mitch towards the end of the movie that she's got a pretty immoral history. One of the things that they don't make very clear in the movie, but when you read about it and you know these things, you can read between the lines. Maybe you can read between the lines in 1951 watching this movie for the first time. But it's very strongly implied that her young husband, years before, mm-hmm. was homosexual, and she bullied him into killing himself. And then, I'm not saying that it's karma, but then she gets bullied, and she doesn't kill herself, but she goes up to the loony bin, mad. So yeah. her life might as well be over anyway.
Yeah.
So, she bullies somebody, yeah. then she gets bullied.
Blanche is no saint. There's yeah. one saint in this movie, and it's Stella. I mean, she's she puts up with a lot, and she's incredibly kind to Blanche, even though Blanche is really condescending and difficult yeah. and high maintenance. You know, the movie's so incredibly insightful. I think probably the script has a lot to do with it. And you could give a lot of credit to the ensemble and Kazan for such realistic portrayals of these characters. But this play just seems to have so much insight. And you compare, yeah, and you compare this portrayal of a tempestuous relationship to, say, the insensitivity with which stuff like this was portrayed in Gone with the Wind. You know, we talked a lot about yeah. the marital rape scene in that movie, and it kind of enraged me because it's just such a false representation of how something like that really is for a victim and for a rapist. It felt disingenuous in a troubling manner. But
and then, well, then don't forget the next morning when we see Scarlett, she's as happy as a guest.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, and that's dangerously ignorant and incorrect portrayal of what marital rape would actually be like. Whereas Streetcar is just so nuanced and it feels so realistic. I mean, this is kind of the genius of it. It feels like by far the most realistic film we've seen on the list yet. Head and shoulders above everything else. There's something just so authentic about these characters, about this situation, even though they're really over the top. Mm-hmm. You know, it's supposed to be so realistic, but they are really over the top. This is another way that Kim Hunter is kind of underrated, because she's so down to earth compared to them.
Yeah.
And it's because she believes Blanche would behave this way, and she believes that Stanley would behave this way, that the audience is allowed to believe that these, like, hysterical characters are actually believable.
Okay, that's great, but I want to bring it back to the end scene, mm-hmm. the rape, which we're going to call it what it is. And I just love the way that this is painted. I said earlier that Stella, okay, she gets hit. We now have seen that. I can't deny it anymore.
I win.
But it's just smart for Tennessee Williams and Kazan as well, and the actors, to have painted it that this isn't as simple as Stella being a shrinking violet. Same with at the end. Blanche, in her lizard brain when she first met Stanley, not the way that it happens, but she wanted something like that to happen. Not the way it happens, I'm not saying that, but she wanted to sleep with this guy. Yeah, and in the end, she gets what she wanted. Obviously, I'm not saying that that's what should have happened.
She wanted to sleep with the guy that came to the door to, what does he try to do? Sell her, collect for the paper.
Right.
Yeah.
Played by Apu on The Simpsons.
I know.
So, I'm trying to word this carefully because I don't want to sound like a lout myself. But I just love the way that they do that. If Blanche was entirely a victim, if Blanche had a history where she was... Okay, here's our first trivia question. What was Blanche's profession before? What did she teach? She was a teacher.
She taught English.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. So if she had just been the English teacher that came in there with her Southern Belle routine, and if that was even real, let's say that wasn't her putting on a show, because when she finally gets real with Mitch towards the end and he sees the way she really looks, not that she's ugly, but she isn't.
Yeah, like, she's older.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Her voice changes. Vivian Leigh is very smart in that moment. And she goes from that, oh, I'm Blanche, to, or like, yeah, this is really me. And she just sounds a lot different.
Yeah.
She's finally, and I've said this so many times, it's a character performing. She's performing yes. the whole movie, and that yes. and that towards the end she finally doesn't. But is there a part in her brain that clicks over that I slept with my sister's husband? I have to justify this some way, so I have to be even more crazy.
Oh, like you think she's putting on
Was crazy? She faking everything we saw till she was finally real with Mitch? And is she really crazy at the end?
But she doesn't...
She's the victim. I'm not saying she's not the victim.
No, but you're suggesting she slept with Stanley before the rape?
No. The rape happens. It's awful. But she has, whether she wanted to or not, against her will or not, she slept with her sister's husband. And don't forget how old this movie is and how old... You know, she's not ancient, but she's an older woman to begin
yeah,
with.
Yeah, and so Southern, so...
She has to justify in her own mind. Again, I can't understand what someone in this situation has been. I've never been in this situation myself. But is there a part of her... Is the movie guilty? In a subtle way
yeah.
implying that there's a guilt for her, that she has to pretend that she's nuts? Because she was pretending before that she was this, oh, I'm Blanche and everything's wonderful and I've got all this perfume and these fancy clothes.
Yeah.
And she's not really like that when she finally lets her guard down.
I see what you're saying, and it's an interpretation, but I don't know if I agree with your interpretation.
But it's yet another layer the movie puts out there.
There's so much, yeah, there's so many layers, there's so much mm-hmm. depth, and her character is a great example.
And the movie
that.
Would have been too easy and would have probably been forgotten in a month if Stanley beat on Stella, and just that was it. And she was not the way she is. She doesn't react minutes later, I want that guy. Mm-hmm. And if Blanche had been a victim from the beginning, if she loses the plantation, mm-hmm. and she has done some things, she's been promiscuous. Not that people shouldn't be promiscuous. We certainly feel differently about that now. But back then, that was terrible, especially for a woman, an unmarried woman, to be sleeping around.
Yeah, yeah. So and then she also lies quite a bit about what she's like. In a way, that's what makes it gross when you learn her true nature is just because she's putting on this elaborate act about what she's really like and how she's really a virtuous Southern belle.
Yeah, we've seen some deluded AFI characters, but whoa.
Oh yeah, she's great. I read a great interpretation about the play where they were saying that her character is, of course, her character just interesting on its own, but she also is meant to be a critique of the Old South versus the New South. The New South is Louisiana, and it's New Orleans, and it's animalistic, rough and real and tough, and bad and mean sometimes, you know, cruel, just like life is. It can be kind of unrelenting and unforgiving and a bad place for a weak woman. Whereas the Old South had this real veneer and pretentiousness.
Yeah, some of our very first AFI movies, The Birth of a Nation, Intolerance, Pelleton Scenes in the South.
Yeah, that's
and The
General.
Example. Three of our first four AFI movies were all set in, all, Intolerance was only
and they have that, like,
set there.
That veneer of the polite South. And, like, a lot of people will tell you that polite, oh, my stars and goddess, you know, that polite act that they put on is really just a mask for rank intolerance and superiority. She's incredibly condescending.
And Stanley's, they keep calling him a Polak. He's from, he's a Polish. He's
got Polish background. Kowalski. And it's an insult.
As if we didn't say already, his last name is Kowalski.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it's this degrading thing to say about him.
They're being kind of racist. Mm. Maybe not racist because they're all white, but still it's that attitude that I'm better than you simply because your ancestors came from Poland. She has that incredibly unbearable air of superiority despite her own pretty crummy situation and the fact that she's forced to live with them. She's homeless without them and she still has this presumption to look down on them.
Yeah.
And the other critique, and I thought this was super interesting because we just watched Place in the Sun and because Vivien Leigh was famous for playing Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind, that this was also Tennessee Williams' criticism of melodrama. It was it was a very popular genre in film and in the theater, and her big elaborate gestures and her language and the way that she is, and she's so phony because she's putting it all on, that is in a way his criticism of old theater and like new theater.
Phony.
Yeah. And his new theater is the method. It's realistic.
And here's our first movie that really hits on method. We talked about A Place in the Sun.
Yeah.
Montgomery Clift didn't want to say he was a method actor, but let's just say he was. But this movie, we're full bore now with Brando.
Oh, yeah.
And even some of his other colleagues. I said last week that Carl Malden, if we haven't talked to him yet, we haven't talked to him.
Well, no,
we said Mitch.
Yeah,
so. Anyway, Carl Malden, Kim Hunter, and some others are all method. Maybe they weren't all method. Malden actually had been acting quite a bit before 1951. Mm-hmm. But Brando in particular, he's the star of this movie, obviously. Although Vivien Leigh is top billed.
Yeah, she probably has more screen time.
All right, so back to Marlon Brando, the guy I said is the greatest actor who ever lived, despite some of his craziness toward the end of his career and some other things that he was just crapping all over movies and becoming so hard to work with. But at this point, he was brilliant. Every year, he did a movie that mattered. He did so many with Kazan at this point. And this is his first of four AFIers. Got On the Waterfront, The Godfather, and Apocalypse Now Yet to Come, all very highly ranked. He and Bogart, when we did the Bogart movies, we were talking about not only is Bogart on four AFI movies, he's in highly ranked AFI movies.
Where does Marlon Brando rank on the AFI's list of movie stars?
I think he might be fourth. And you know, the irony is that I think we talked about this before, and if we didn't, I'll make it clear now, that when they did that movie star thing, which I hate that list, not that it's terrible that some of the people they chose, it was that you had to be either dead or you had to start making movies before 1950 or before.
That's so
Brando
weird.
Just made the cut, because he was still alive when they did the list. For many years he was, actually. And he just made the cut by making The Men in 1950, the year before this, which was his first performance.
That's so weird.
It is. It's so subjective.
It's a weird criteria.
Yeah, it's bad criteria, actually. But in any case, he was near the top, but he wasn't number one. It was Bogey.
Mm-hmm.
But he did work for 50 more years, Brando did, and we all know the rest of the resume, I guess. I mean, I mentioned four great films, but he was in other ones. Last Tango in Paris is a great movie, but not American. He had his role in Superman. Maybe not a great one, but...
Yeah.
But that was when he started making his huge paychecks.
That's when he started really phoning it in, too.
Yeah. And John Garfield, who we will not cover on this list, on the top 100 list, he could have played Stanley, but he did not want to be subservient to what he thought Blanche would be the bigger player. And maybe Lee won the Oscar, Brando didn't. Lee was a bigger name going in, and Brando wasn't as big as her, and yet Brando certainly became the star after this.
But Blanche is clearly the main character of the play. And that's what Garfield is seeing. Fair. Yeah,
Garfield saw that, I guess, and realized.
It's a movie about Blanche, and Stanley is a character in that story. It's certainly an ensemble, but how could anybody really say that she's not the lead character?
Well, she is.
Yeah, yeah. So and that's why he refused to do it.
Yep.
God forbid.
So as for Blanche Vivian Leigh, it's her second of two AFIers after, of course, Gone with the Wind. And Leigh was bipolar. I don't know if she'd already been at this point, but she certainly was later. And she started acting like Blanche in real life.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the ultimate method performance.
Like literally answering to Blanche,
so she
right?
was being method in her real life all that time, yeah. She took long breaks between movies all along anyway, and she only made three more after this one. And even though she lived another 16 years, she only made five movies between Gone with the Wind and Streetcar Named Desire, which were, really 12 years apart.
Well, I guess she was working in the theater, too, so that could have kept her busy. Mm.
She was married to Laurence Olivier, too, and she would have been supporting his career. But definitely the bipolarism would have had something to do with that, I think.
Interesting, of why she would have chosen this role, why maybe she did such a great job.
Yep. Olivia de Havilland could have played the character, but she turned it down. And Jessica Tandy probably wanted it, but did not get it.
Mm-hmm.
As for Kim Hunter, now just like last week's writer of A Place in the Sun, Michael Wilson, she was blacklisted for supposed communist sympathies.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah, what a shame. And she did not make very many movies in the rest of the 50s.
So did, like, Elia Kazan finger her?
I didn't read that part.
Because when you look at that, that seems like quite the coincidence that Kazan was...
Worked with her and then mentioned names, yeah. Well, in any case, though, she didn't work all that much for a long time, and her most popular and famous role would probably be Zira in the Planet of the Apes series.
Uh-huh.
As for the supporting players, Carl Malden would certainly be the top of that list. He worked in movies for nearly 70 years.
Wow.
This man lived a long time, and he's also a noted member of the Academy. He's going to be on the waterfront for us in a few weeks from now, and then Patton, quite a ways away from us. At the end of the year, we'll get to Patton. And he was also in the 70s TV show The Streets of San Francisco with Michael Douglas, where Michael got his start.
And he certainly deserves credit for contributing to this. I think the role of Mitch is really well played by him and like a great addition, a great counterpoint to Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. You know what's funny is there's two times that they kind of get in a fight, and both times it's mild-mannered Mitch that tries to start it, and it's Stanley who calmly stands back while other people hold Mitch back.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Mitch is supposed to be the mild-mannered one, and Stanley is supposed to be the maniac.
Yeah, Stanley may not be a very good friend on top of everything else.
I don't think he's a very good friend at all.
Yeah. Now, other people that none of us have ever heard of before, but I'll just mention them because they were also in the play, and they were Rudy Bond, who played Steve, one of Stanley's buddies, and Nick Dennis, who played Pablo, another one of his buddies. Oh, and the doctor, Richard Garrick. It says a doctor in the credits. They must mean the guy at the end.
Yeah, you know, the guy who takes her.
The kindness
the stranger,
of strangers.
Yeah.
And how can we forget Peg Hillius? I guess is how you say her name. She was Eunice.
Ah, yes.
I'm actually going to burn... I'm going to ruin my own trivia question by saying this, but who is the last person in this movie that we see? The last face on screen.
Is it Eunice?
It is Eunice.
Oh, gosh,
She's standing on the stairs. Stella goes past her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right, because she goes up the stairs and kind of leaves Stanley, maybe? Mm-hmm.
I think she's supposed to be married to... Would it be Pablo or Steve? One of those two.
And they have their own tempestuous relationship.
Yeah, that's a very noisy courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see something reminiscent of that in Raging Bull, where De Niro is fighting with his neighbors, yelling at them, which apparently was something that really happened when they were shooting.
Yeah.
And De Niro played off the idea that this guy was yelling at whoever this person was, who happened to be Robert De Niro playing a movie scene. Well, we just mentioned the name's namer. That would be Elia Kazan, his first of two AFIers. We're going to go on their waterfront. Brando and Malden again a couple of weeks from now. He also directed Gentleman's Agreement, which won the Oscar for him and for Best Picture. Not a very good movie, I don't think. And East of Eden, which was a pretty good movie. That's with James Dean and some other people. He directed a lot of people to Oscar nominations and Oscar wins. He was a great actor's director, no matter what his politics may have been. Now, did you notice the opening credits call it an Elia Kazan production?
Yeah.
He's not a producer.
Yeah.
It's a rare thing to say production.
He's just probably full of himself, that's all. He's just an ego.
Now, Kazan actually was one of the co-founders of the Actors Studio, which is one of the things that got the method on track.
Strasberg.
But he also named names to the House Un-American Activities Committee.
And this is forever going to change his legacy. Yeah.
Well, the thing I'll always remember about him, apart from his films, because he did make some great films, two in particular, Streetcar and Waterfront, but when he won the honorary Oscar in 1999,
I remember
Nick
this.
Nolte, Ed Harris, Amy Madigan, who's Nolte's, Harris's wife, sat on their hands with these looks on their faces like, nope.
A lot of people sat.
And people like Warren Beatty, Martin Scorsese, they were applauding vociferously for Kazan.
Mm-hmm.
They appreciated his art. I believe Scorsese and De Niro presented him with the award, come to think of it.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, so they would look past the politics of it, but Kazan
was not. He's one of many filmmakers on this list that have a questionable history of doing some kind of despicable things, and you kind of have to juggle with how much you can appreciate their artistry. And
let's
their
not
craft.
Get into this in a whole tangent.
Oh no!
But just very briefly, I want to say I was reading about today that now it's really coming out again that Woody Allen maybe supposedly molested his own kid.
He's a great example.
And we know Roman Polanski back in the 70s.
Yeah, beloved and detested.
Both of them. As artists, though, they are worshipped, those two guys.
Yeah,
and Kazan, for the most part, was worshipped, too.
There's this brilliant headline in The Onion, which has a picture of Woody Allen and him saying, "Boy, I've really put you in a tough spot, haven't I?" And the article is amazing. I can't recommend it enough. It just sums up this feeling perfectly of loving an artist's work but hating something else that they've done in their life.
Yeah, Woody just won a Golden Globe. What was it, the DeMille Award?
That's right,
Keaton ramblingly accepted for him. And he's nominated for yet another writing Oscar.
All it's done is kind of stir up the pot again and remind everybody of you can do something bad enough in your personal life that should affect your professional life, especially if you're a public figure.
I may not be in the right frame of mind on this, but I do tend to try to overlook these things as much as I absolutely possibly can.
It's hard because, when you really love their movies.
Because I want to see these great films. And in the end, I don't. It's like when people get upset about somebody not being nice. I mean, we all want movie stars and athletes to be nice people, but in the end, I'm watching them because they're good at what they do. I don't really care what they do behind the closed doors, except when they are abusing people or
there's a line
raping
between
people or
being
hurting
nice.
People.
Yeah, there's a line that you cross between being nice and actually ruining Kim Hunter's career, potentially. And if not her career, then certainly other people's careers. Kazan ruined to save his own butt, I guess.
Well, let's save the rest of this part because this is going to be a subtext, almost text, in On the Waterfront.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Because Brando's character names.
Oh,
you haven't seen On the Waterfront?
Oh, I look forward to that then. Yeah. No, I've never seen. That's another one that I'm embarrassed.
Another Actors Studio classic.
I'm really looking forward to that. And when is that?
1954. So,
1954.
A couple more weeks from now.
Oh, great.
A little ways away, but not too far.
That'll be some rich fodder for conversation, I'm sure.
All right, so just to wrap up the behind-the-scenes people, Tennessee Williams, you've mentioned him, I've mentioned him. He wrote the screenplay with Oscar Saul, who helped him out with it.
And however much Oscar Saul helped him or didn't.
It's Tennessee Williams.
Their title card for that is like, Tennessee Williams, big take up the whole screen. Oh, Oscar Saul. It's like a quarter of the size of Tennessee Williams' credit.
Yeah, Tennessee wrote a lot of famous scripts and plays that turned into movies. One would certainly be Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, which also had a homosexual subplot that was changed.
That's right.
Where Paul Newman's character, Brick, is supposed to have been flat out gay and in love with his friend, and that's what his torture is all about and why he's an alcoholic. But in the movie, it's that they were just really close and I miss my friend so much.
And that's, why bother making
but
the
that's
movie
why
if
he
you
can't
have
sleep
to bury
with
that
wife.
Context?
Yeah, he can't sleep with Elizabeth Taylor because he's guilty, but in the play, it's that he's not straight.
Great, great writer. Really, brilliant stuff.
He was. I don't believe we cover him anymore, though. I don't think he is involved in anything
else. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think so. The producer. It was not a Charles Feldman production. It was a Neely Kazan production, but Charles Feldman should have got that credit. This is his only AFI-er, but he also did production work on Red River and The 7 Year Itch, neither one of which are AFI films. He ended his career with Casino Royale, the original version, in the mid-60s, one of the many Bond films. Not really official, but in a way
it's
a Bond
Peter Sellers
film.
One, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, Peter Sellers and, Now, technically, behind the scenes, we had some pretty impressive people. This movie did win at least the one Oscar for the sets. But first of all, Alex North wrote the jazzy music score. He also composed for Spartacus, Kubrick's movie, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And then Kubrick hired him to write the music for 2001, but then he went with the infamous classical music in that film instead. I don't think it was a matter of, oh, your score's not good enough, Alex. Just that this music works better, But North was a 15-time Oscar loser, and he got an honorary award in 1986, at least. But he wrote a lot of classic scores, and when we get to the awards and other AFI list, he's going to be on the list of top 100 music, top 25, I should say, music scores.
Nice. Wow.
The cinematographer, Harry Stradling Sr., he also photographed My Fair Lady. What a difference, because this movie, as we said, now that one actually is for the most part inside Henry Higgins' vast house, but it's also full color Technicolor.
Very conventional Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And not in this black and white small.
Yeah.
And there's and My Fair Lady is a small main cast, but there's more people in general. Anyway, he shot both those movies, and we'll see that one eventually.
This is a much more innovatively shot film, I would say.
Yeah, because it's so small. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And because the way the light is and the continually
inside
the
movies
shadows.
Are never get enough credit for being able to make it look interesting. I'm not saying it's easy to just go out to Montana and shoot the big sky, but that is kind of like nature's doing it for you.
Yeah, a little bit. Rather than creating something from scratch.
Well, one of the best looking films we've seen yet, or maybe we'll ever see, is Citizen Kane. And for the most part, that sets and that's inside. And that was, of course, Greg Tolan, too. We've talked about him a lot. The sets, the guy who won the Oscar, George James Hopkins. He also did sets for Casablanca, My Fair Lady, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Hmm. He took home Oscars for this movie, My Fair Lady and Virginia Woolf. The influence of Streetcar. This is a pretty vast one. Of course, there's been many stage versions, including the play that presaged the movie. Then there's the Alec Baldwin, Jessica Lange version in 1995. I've never seen this, nor have I ever seen the Treat Williams and Margaret TV movie in 1984. I don't know that would really work too well. Treat Williams has been in some good things. And Margaret's got some charm, but I don't know about that one. And The Simpsons. We haven't quoted them as much as I thought we would in this, actually.
I've been very tempted to. Their version is so great. It's one of my favorite Simpsons episodes. It's so funny.
We may have to watch it again soon.
But of course, the joke is just how much they're butchering this beautiful play by turning it into a musical. Oh my God, it's so great.
They are white-hot grease fires of pure entertainment. I guess the other influence you got to mention is that this movie, I would say at least, helped movies grow up and deal with mature
it feels and real so topics. Yeah.
Because they did let them get away with a lot. Yeah, they cut out some things we've talked about, but they still let them get away with an awful lot of tough topics. We talked about In Wonderful Life. There was a line where Jimmy Stewart was supposed to say something about being nuts. I'm a nut, sure. That's offensive, and yet some of the things that we see in this movie aren't. And I'm glad they didn't cut them out.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. It feels just like they're taking some of the veil off. It's such a realistic film. Even Stanley having sweat all over his shirt. I feel like we haven't seen something like that yet. A character like him and relationships that they have in this film. Everything about it just feels so gritty.
Well, the people people, especially early on, are always in their underwear, too. Blanche is, and he is.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
And Stella is. That's the authenticity. They would in their, and they're
but
hot.
I can see how it forever changed film and forever influenced film to just open the doors of the private homes of these families, of these psyches, even.
And another influence, we just talked about the director who wrote this movie that is up for some Oscars in a couple of weeks from now, and that would be Woody Allen's film Blue Jasmine.
Yeah, that's right.
Cate Blanchett's character is absolutely, at least to me, is influenced.
I haven't seen
by
it yet.
Blanche.
I'm dying to see it.
And right down to she goes and stays with a sister, who she seems to have some contempt for, and there's
her working class husband.
Yeah, and there's problems. Yeah, so the movie had to have been influenced by Streetcar. Mm-hmm. And Blanchett may very well win the Oscar, and she probably should. She's great, but she's very much like Blanche.
Yeah.
Very delusional and has a very sordid history.
I'll see it soon, I promise.
Right. Lots of influence from Streetcar on the history of cinema. The awards, another AFI list. The movie won 4 Oscars, Best Actress for Vivien Leigh, Supporting Actress for Kim Hunter, and Maldon won for Best Supporting Actor, and of course the sets. He's also nominated for 8 others, so 12 total nominations. Picture, director, actor for Brando, but he didn't win, unfortunately. Tennessee Williams' script, the cinematography, the costumes, the sound, and Alex North's music. Of course, he didn't win because he never won until they gave him an honorary award. The National Film Registry started protecting the movie in 1999, so it took them 10 years, but at least they're protecting it now. And by the way, we watched the DVD I've owned for a long time. It didn't look incredible, but I thought it looked all right.
Yeah.
We're going to see some Blu-rays soon. Sing in the Rain I got for Christmas. We're going to see that in Blu-ray. We're going to see Shane in Blu-ray. Hopefully they'll be cleaner than this one was, but I thought it looked okay. And by the way, I guess we said this, but we're still doing black and white films.
Yeah.
And we're still doing 4:3 aspect ratios.
Yeah, 4:3. I mean, that's going to change soon,
right? Very soon, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But back to Streetcar, the AFI list now. So 2 lines from the Top 100 Quotes list. We've probably mentioned them both already. I've always depended on the kindness of strangers was 75th. And hey, Stella! was 45th. Now, there's a bit of a story I want to tell about this. When I was a kid, my father's friends, and maybe my father too, I don't recall, when we were young, we'd go to car shows and stuff, and those fellows would have 1 or 2 beers through the course of the night.
Just 1 or 2?
Probably only 1 or 2. And they would start yelling that. I don't know if they knew somebody named Stella, or if they knew somebody that was maybe named Estelle or something, they're playing off her name. But I remember that even to this day, that they would do that. And I was asleep. I think they woke me up sometimes bellowing about Stella. They must have been Streetcar fans.
Yeah.
And that would have been the mid to late 70s, so you're talking
25
years
ago. And that's how
movie.
It ends up on the quote list.
Yeah.
I have to say, the line, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers. I mean, it's so famous, but I can't say I really understand why it's such a great line.
I'm not a big fan of it.
Why it's such a great way to kind of close off Blanche's story in that film. You don't get it either. You're kind of with me on this.
No, unless the idea is it's the irony that she's full of crap. And like I said, she's been performing this whole time, and now she still is.
And she's been depending on the kindness of her sister for months and months.
The only non-stranger to her.
Yeah, I don't really understand that. Now, of course, she's losing Stella, so she will have to depend on the kindness of strangers from this point on. And it is her going back to her phony Southern Belle ways of just being like, I just have to say whatever it is I have to say to get this man to like me and possibly like me so that he'll take care of me so that I can get my way.
All right, enough of tangents here. The movie
so
was
so much to say. There's so many tangents really to go on.
The movie was 67th on the top 100 Passions. I could definitely see, have seen it being in the top 20.
Yeah.
And it was 19th for Alex North's score on the top 25 music scores.
So wait, A Place in the Sun scored higher on the Passions list than
I believe it
Streetcar
did.
Named Desire? For shame, AFI, for shame.
Clutch my pearls. All right, this has been a long podcast, and I won't even bother with any more trivia, but let's wrap. Brando's brilliant. Lee's great. Hunter's really great. Never given nearly enough credit for this movie. Mauldin's good. The supporting cast are all good. Kazan, Williams, everybody.
Yeah.
But I think that Brando is the best thing. And most people who've ever seen the movie seem to agree. But
yes.
Yeah. Your parting thoughts. Oh, do you think it belongs in the list where it is in the
mid-40s? Oh my gosh, yeah. I would say I can't believe it dropped.
It wasn't a long drop, but yeah, it was.
Yeah, yeah. I hope that trend doesn't continue. I think it's a beautiful, incredible, and powerful film. And there's just, you know, you could watch it over and over again and still glean things from it that you didn't notice the first time you saw it. There's so much to it. It's really a beautiful piece of art.
Well, this is one of the great things about this project is you're seeing movies that we would have eventually watched anyway, but now you have to see them. And every once in a while, you're seeing one
really
that blows you away.
Well, this really didn't feel like homework. This one I could recommend really easily to anybody. It's beautiful. Really, really great.
Well, the next one you may not feel quite the same way about. Now, we just mentioned a minute ago that we've done black and white for a long time now on the Top 100 Project. We finally break that streak because up next on the project is our first glance at the singing and dancing talents of Gene Kelly in An American in Paris, which is full color Technicolor, and it'll be vivid, at least. I haven't seen the movie since 1998, but we will finally
see it soon. I've never seen it, but I am historically far more forgiving of musicals than you are. I'm a sucker for dancing, man. I do love to watch
dancing.
You're
going to see a long ballet sequence in this
movie. I heard. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I don't know if I'm looking forward to the rest of it, because if it has like swing time antics in it, then you can expect
it'll
me
be
to
nothing
just
like what we just talked about. I just know that much. Yeah. Method is not in this movie. So the coming attractions trivia question for An American Paris. Now, you, Bev, said a few podcasts ago that American is a popular word in movie titles. So how many AFI films have America or American in their title?
That's a great question. For the answer to that trivia question, please check out our podcast next week for American in Paris. And for lots more trivia and lots more stuff in general, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of Streetcar Named Desire? Please let us know. We'd love to hear what you guys think. Email us at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
You can always depend on the kindness of strangers to buck up your spirit and something or other. Now here's a different plan you won't regret.
A stranger's just a friend you haven't met.
You haven't met. Streetcar!